Welcome to the Secure Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity. Each episode will focus on a specific topic or two of interest to the community. Today, we're talking the Verizon 2021 DBI report.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone, do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Today, we're talking about the brand new DBIR that was just released six months ago. And we appreciate all the loyal listeners just hanging in there waiting for us to do this. All those Twitter messages saying, we need the DBIR. We need the DBIR.
It's like angry villagers at the gate.
So in the past, when we've looked at reports like this, we've done an exhaustive run through of every single page. And those typically run to over an hour and they're a little bit long. So we thought maybe this time what we would do is something more of a top 10 format where each of us picked five items we thought were noteworthy and we're going to discuss each one briefly. I will warn you, I picked my five first and David said that I got all the good ones. So damn. But the whole report was 100 plus pages. So you can feel free to thank us for not going through every one of them. I'll go ahead and start with one of my top five. First one is that the hacking category doesn't include very much hacking. When I first was looking over it without really reading it, I was like, oh my God, like web application hacking is way up there. We're not doing enough on that. We need to refocus our security program on that. But if you really dig down into it, it's almost all credential reuse brute forcing. I guess they didn't have a better category to put that in, but in my opinion, that doesn't really count as hacking. On page 18, they said hacking was the most prevalent method at the beginning of a breach, which again was like, oh man, look at that. That's crazy. But then they said that 89% of the hacking varieties were credential reuse brute force. So it turns out that actual like real web application hacking is a fairly minor part of that. But, and we talked about this last week, like this does have an action item for you at a company. Get your two-factor in place. If 89% of the largest category of ways that attackers break in is credential reuse, brute force, multi-factor auth kills it almost completely, except for the occasional person that just gets the pop-up on their phone and they say yes, because whatever. And making sure that you use complicated, unique credentials on everything that's web accessible. Big thing. The other top item right under, I'm sorry, actually, before I start talking about phishing, did you have anything on this one, David?
I was just going to mention that this is one of the problems with some of the terminology using hacking versus attacking, where what is an attack versus an actual hack?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking like SQL injection and cross-site scripting and exploiting vulnerabilities.
Right, where these are all attacks, brute forcing, cross-site scripting, those are all attacks, but actual hacks are a subset of those. It's certainly not what I would call, yeah, or not what I would consider credential reuse or brute force.
Yeah. So the other top item, and I'm not on my other top five, I'm just including this. The other top item there is phishing. So really, if you can squash credential reuse and you can squash fixing, and you can squash phishing, you're like 80% of the way there.
Yeah, but you can't squash phishing. You can reduce it, but you can't stop it.
Yeah, that's fair. What's your first top five?
First one is that DDoS, or not DDoS, but actual DOS was 50% of all incidents.
That is so much.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that all? Like booter services where they're just flooding your connection, or are there things like breaking into and shutting down services? Are those included in denial of service? Ransomware included in denial of service since it shuts off, prevents you from using the computer?
Ransomware was not included in that. It was other than ransomware. So it's denial of service, gotcha, other than ransomware.
Interesting.
But it does include any kind of resource exhaustion, whether it be application, network, anything that can cause a denial of service, crash the application. So all of those are included in there. But of course, the focus is on the bandwidth utilization, which is what most of DOS is now.
Yeah.
And what was interesting was that they said that 95% of all DOS incidents fell between 13 megabytes to 99 gigabytes. So that's not a lot in terms of what you can get from it from a DDoS mitigation provider. And the reason that they think these are so low is that denial of service gets blocked at various stages along the internet. ISPs do some blocking, autonomous system numbers, ASNs do some blocking, and content or delivery networks do some blocking. So you figure maybe those denial of services could be larger or start out larger, but by the time they get to their destination, to the victim, then they've dwindled down to less than 100 gigs. And considering that, not if you get a DDoS mitigation provider that can protect you against denial of services over 100 gigs, then you're good to go. You don't even need to get a really high-end or really expensive denial of service provider as long as they can meet that bar of 100 gigs. You're good against 95% of attacks.
That's really interesting because that did not seem... Everybody's always looking for what's the big one? What's the biggest one we'd have to deal with?
Those are the ones that hit the news.
Yeah.
It's kind of like those things of 99 smart people do this, these five things. They don't talk about the other stupid things that those smart people do every day.
Yeah.
Because they don't get the headlines.
My number two, APT ain't shit. And that is because the state
you affiliated... tell that to their face.
Yeah, I'm going to put this on the internet. They found that the state affiliated actors were way at the bottom, making up a tiny fraction of attackers this last year, which is interesting because in the past years, in 2016 through 2018, espionage and APT actors were way higher. And I don't know if it's that they're actually calming down, or alternatively, they pointed out that some APT actors want cash too. I know North Korea for sure has been caught stealing Bitcoin and stealing money to pull back to the motherland.
I wonder if it's part of the change in their definition, what's an APT or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, attribution is always interesting. And a lot of APT actors, they use the minimum required complexity to get in. So are they blending in with the organized crime? If they are, it means you don't have to, you know, specifically target them with defenses unless you have a real reason to.
How do you get that sweet money, though?
We're targeted by APT-32.
You have to in order to get the money. Yeah. That's how you get your budget hyped up, is because you're a victim of ATP or they're after you.
Yeah.
You know, Bob's bait and tackle.
They're after our fishing gear. You know, they've got a special way of tying a fly that's just so perfect for those trout streams.
Yep. So the next one is that something that was in the report that was interesting was that both small and large organizations have almost the same amount of attacks. The small organizations can no longer hide behind the idea that they're too small for anyone to consider. I wonder what's the ratio of attackers versus organizations out there just in general. Because I'm sure there are attackers who understand that their capabilities may not be on the level where they can bother attacking Citibank because there's no point because they don't have the skill set to get there. Yeah. So maybe they choose smaller businesses to attack because it's more likely that they're going to be able to actually get through their defenses because their skill set is on par with their own. It's like the attackers. I'm at this level, so I just need to find an organization that is slightly below my capabilities.
Yeah. I don't know if it's deliberately targeted or just the attackers that are sending out the mass mails to literally everybody on the internet are catching smaller fish more often. Because they don't know if they don't have the proof point, they don't have the email gateway filtering, they don't have the phishing awareness training that's so effective.
Right.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. So definitely these types of attacks are certainly more damaging to a small organization. You take a couple $100,000 off a small company and they might not make payroll that month.
Yeah. On the other side, they might be able to recover faster because they have a smaller footprint.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or are leveraging more SaaS solutions versus on-prem solutions.
Yeah. If they're using like Google Mail or something, they've already got pretty good phishing coverage, for example.
Right.
All right. My number three is business email compromise attacks, which, by the way, I don't think these should be called this. I think these should be called wire transfer fraud attacks. That's my own internal nomenclature for this type of attack. So WTF attacks more than doubled again last year. They went up from around, it was hard to tell a little bit because of the way that they have their chart set up, but it looked like it went from around 2.5% to 10% of the non-DDoS incidents. Of course, the non-denial of service, because you mentioned before, denial of service was 50% of the incidents. The median loss was $30,000. Again, if it's a couple person company, like that's the 95% of the BEC's loss ranged from $250 all the way up to $984,855, which is quite a range, but that makes sense. There's a whole bunch of stuff lumped into here. This goes from gift card fraud all the way up to convincing the CFO that you've got a secret purchase coming up and you need $1 million to buy a new company. What was interesting here is 58% of the detected incidents were successful. And at first I thought that was ridiculously high, but then I realized it's probably because only the really big deals were reported escalated to Verizon. Because I'm sure that probably a lot of the gift card fraud might have never gotten reported, or when people realized it was a fraud, they may not have wanted to tell their boss or tell anyone that they were defrauded of $200 in gift cards.
If that were the case, then that percentage would be even higher then, right?
I'm sure there were some people that reported it, but I just feel like it's a lot harder to hide when you pay out $50,000 of the company's money versus the gift card stuff, which is usually out of your personal money. And then you're supposed to go seek reimbursement from the company.
Yeah, but if that percentage were lower than that, then that would mean there would be a higher percentage of unsuccessful ones, which were not included in the data set.
I guess the question is, what constitutes a incident that was escalated to this report that was unsuccessful? Because I think that's a product of a skewed data set, because companies have detected business email compromises all the time, but we don't report those to Verizon.
Yeah. And I think something that might skew that data set is these are not detected the vast majority of the time.
Yeah.
By outside of the security team. So you may have people in the accounting office that are detecting and preventing these all day long, but those are not getting written down and sent to the security team.
Because those are the people that are just following the process. They're calling and making the second check or being like, this is not how we pay stuff. So, yeah.
So I don't dispute, you're probably right, but that percentage is high. But I think the reason is that for business email compromises, most of the detection and prevention measures lie outside of security teams.
That's fair. Yeah. But I did see what's interesting here is most social engineering attacks are discovered by external parties. That seems super weird to me for this type of thing.
How?
How is the people outside detecting that you accidentally, or that maybe they're counting Discover when the vendor doesn't get paid and the vendor comes back to you 30 days later and they're like, hey, you're now 30 days late on your account. Yeah, I don't know. This one didn't seem a little weird to me, but.
Yeah, that's a bit odd. Yeah. Well, one of the gems in here is the miscellaneous effects. So one of the items that they mentioned in here is that there were only 20 in the whole data set. There were only 20 skimming incidents. So incidents where a skimmer had been used on an ATM or a gas pump or what have you, which is a significant decrease from last year's report, which is 30. So a 50% drop in skimmers. And this is a huge decline from the peak of 206 in 2013. So 8 years ago, 7, if you just from this data being collected in 2020. And they suggest that this decrease may be caused because fewer people are traveling due to COVID-19. But considering this is a trend from 2013 to now, I think this may be more related to the change in just the card security environment. The movement to chip and PIN was mandated for the United States in 2015. In other parts of the world, chip and PIN was in place before then and had greater, broader adoption of chip and PIN. So I think really it's a change in the security mechanism around the card environment that are making skimming devices less profitable.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me too that as gas stations are more aware of this, because definitely over the last 5 years or so, I've seen a lot more gas stations with the security things, and they're actually checking and watching for skimmers. This may just be a long-term trend. Maybe it was accelerated a bit by COVID, but...
And it's like I said, it's actually changes in the security environment for the cards, chip and PIN, as well as other security mechanisms for where cards are actually swiped at or used at point of sales, or I'm not sure the right term for pumps and ATMs, what you'd call that.
Yeah.
Point of use systems. But also under miscellaneous effects was environmental effects. So they had one instance of fire, one instance of hurricane, and one instance of tornado, which all ended up scattering sensitive data to the wind, literally, with documents. Because I think a lot of people aren't even considering those kinds of things when there's a tornado warning, that the sensitive data is going to be scattered around. So you might want to consider where you're storing your paper documents if you're in an area that's in the Southeast where you're going to get the hurricanes, or if you're in the Midwest where you're going to get the tornadoes, where are your documents stored at, and what's going to happen if your building's hit by a tornado? And are those going to be sent all over the place? Should you send them to an Iron Mountain or whatever when there's tornado warning or something? I don't know. Moved into the basement.
Well, and that's one of those things where even if the documents being scattered across your county is probably not going to lead to large scale exploitation of the data by competitors in other countries or whatever, or criminals, like, you still have to report it. It still counts as a data breach.
Yeah, you're probably not getting a lot of attackers running around picking up individual pieces of paper.
Did you hear there was a tornado at GE's headquarters? Let's go.
It's like the movie Twister, except for with the hackers running around picking up paper.
Yeah. Hackers in a tornado. That's what it is. That's the latest. Going to be the latest sci-fi movie. They're going to be spinning around in the tornado while they're hacking into your systems.
Yeah, it's going to outsell Sharknado. Which I actually tried to watch that.
It's so bad.
Man, I couldn't mask 5 minutes. 5 minutes. That's Everybody ridiculous. Was talking about it, how horrible it was. You had to see it. I could not make it to 5 minutes. It was terrible.
Yeah, either. Which is funny because I like there's a ton of terrible movies. Yeah, Lake Placid. I love Lake Placid.
Oh, that movie.
Deep Blue Sea is so good. What's the one with Treat Williams where it's like a cruise ship and like a weird like squid?
Oh, something terror.
I don't know. But there's so many of those movies that I love. And Sharknado is just a...
Yes. What is that? I think it's The Girl from Ipanema. You would have seen a movie to get that joke. But anyway.
Deep Rising. That was the name of it. Deep Rising. I love that movie. That movie's so good.
They escape on a jet ski, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but I love B-horror movies and those kinds of things.
Exactly.
But Sharknado, I could not do it.
Slither was pretty good too. Although that one was another one they were definitely shooting for that. But
yeah, there's some B-movies that are designed to be B-movies.
Yeah.
Big fan of B-movies. B-horror movies in particular.
Yeah. All right, there's my number four, I think. Web application attacks are on the rise. Looks like they've increased from 10% to 16% in incidents. This is actually very related to what I was talking about for the first one, because a lot of these web applications are credential stuffing. So even though, again, it calls it web application attacks, it's really looking at credential stuffing and brute forcing. So it did drop. It was 30% of the breaches in last year's report. It's down to 26%, but it's still a big part. One of the interesting things here is that they mentioned that most of the use of credentials in these attacks was not preceded by any detected social engineering, which probably means that it was A, either unreported, the user didn't realize it, or B, credential stuffing, which we've already talked about.
Yeah, and if it's credential stuffing, and this is actually mentioned later in the report about monitoring service in the dark web, but if you have let me rephrase this. One way to help prevent or minimize the effects of credential stuffing is to have a service that monitors dark web, or you monitor have I been pwned in order to look for employee accounts and then check those against your existing systems to see if they've reused their passwords or not. Yeah. And a lot of times HR organizations, because they dealt with the people before they were employees, have their private email address that they can use to do these kinds of correlations, as well as their company email address, which is a lot of times what the usernames are for a lot of sites these days. So you have the ability to do the correlation between these other data breaches and your own systems. It takes some work to get it in place, but I think you could pay some good dividends there.
Yeah, and I know some of them are free. Like you mentioned, Have I Been Pwned? It's free. You just have to, if you set up something on your main website showing you own it, you can monitor all emails with that domain for free. They did have a list of percentages here for what percentage of web attacks were what. And the percentages they have add up to over 100%. So I assume that means that they were used in multiple ones of these. But use of stolen credentials, the credential stuffing we talked about before, 80% of these attacks, brute force, 15% of these attacks, and then 15% are actual exploit vulnerability and or misconfiguration, taking advantage of misconfigurations. So again, it adds up to 110%. Their number is not mine. I think it has to do with the uncertainty and the rounding they do, and maybe again, multiple techniques were used in a single one. But again, it's creds and it's brute force.
You know what I think it is? The hackers are just that committed that they give 110%.
Man, I tell you what, I read this and this is just the stupidest thing. Like it's got to be so easy for them to just run their scanners, their credential stuffing scanners, and just flip and sit back and then log in and install their crypto miner and just walk away. But anyway, speaking of what they did with the actual hacked systems, again, this percentage adds up to more than 100% because I'm sure they did more than one of these things on there. In 75% of instances, they repurposed the system to distribute malware or to act as part of a sharing network or something like that. Yeah, wares. 55% of the time, they defaced it. And for only 40% of the time, did they install some sort of software, almost always a crypto miner of some kind, although occasionally malware. So that seems so weird to me.
I can't believe defacement is 55%. Dude, that's like from 20 years ago.
I know. But again, look at how they're getting in, like use of stolen creds and brute force. Like there's probably a lot of script kiddies in here.
That's crazy. But something else in the report. So if you go down into the report, they have different industry trends and analysis. So I thought what would be interesting is to pull out the financial services, because everybody touts financial services as being, you know, on the cutting edge, or people assume that financial services on the cutting edge of cybersecurity defense. So some of the interesting data points from that is that for financial services that were involved in data breaches, they really relied on 74% of the breaches being notified of 74% of the breaches by someone other than their own teams. Whether it be bad guys, which is 38%, basically hackers telling them they've been compromised, or other monitoring services, which is 36%. And when they say monitoring service, I believe this, I'm not sure exactly what they mean by that. My assumption is one of two things, either an MSSP or actually a service that monitors the dark web for evidence of selling the company's credentials or other pieces of data.
You know, there are a startling number of those companies that send emails to your company saying stuff like, hey, we found this on the dark web and let's have a sales call so we can help you find more of them.
It's probably not hard, but that means only 26% of the time were the financial service organizations able to identify the compromise themselves.
Well, they're using stolen legitimate credentials to get in. It looks fine to them.
That's true. But I think one of the things to take away from this is that monitoring services are worth the money.
Yeah.
You know, at 36%, that's nothing to scoff at. So paying a service that's going to monitor the dark web for you and look for possible stolen credentials, with that kind of return on investment, I think that's a wise decision for organizations to...
I don't know. That's, the dark web is so big and so amorphous. I wonder, you know, you remember a couple of years ago how they did the comparison of all the different threat intel lists and found out that there's only a tiny amount of overlap on the threat intel lists. And some people were like, this means you have to get them all. And then other people were like, this means they're worthless because even if you get one or two, if you can't afford them all, then why the hell are you bothering trying? I'd like to see a comparison of what the dark web vendors do. Are they searching the same sites? Are they looking at different sites? Are they, is like the secret sauce? Because the whole point of the dark web is it's not searchable. You have to find it somehow.
These dark web monitoring services come up with some mechanism to do it. So I'm sure they're not doing it all manually. They've come up with some automated way to do it.
That's how they're hiring people to manually go through and find every dark website.
The mention about the IOC thing, though, would be interesting is to take that and say, okay, all these IOC lists, there's no overlap, and then look at IOCs that were actually found by companies and say, does that also have no overlap with those IOCs? Because if you're talking about actual indicators of compromise that a company found in their systems, and indicators of compromise that reside on an IOC list, if those also don't overlap, then that certainly shows that IOC lists are completely useless.
Yeah.
Because what you're talking about is all, you're talking about like thousands of silos, really.
Mm-hmm.
Because if an attacker can alter their malware just a tiny bit, then, you know, that's going to show up as a different IOC.
Yeah. Yeah, when we talked about that, like the whole pyramid of pain thing, like the IP addresses are super easy to change and there's an infinite number of them effectively. So, yeah.
And one of the other interesting things about the financial services section was it said 44% of breaches in that vertical are caused by internal actors. Which is a lot more than worst enemy. I thought. Yeah, we've met the enemy and they are us. But the majority of these were by accident. And 55% of those accidents were emails sent to the wrong person, which accounted for 13% of overall breaches for the whole year. So if you implement DLP nowhere else but your email, you're going to benefit from that, because that's where a lot of data is being sent by accident outside of your organization. So you catch the mistakes as well as the legitimate or the actual malicious actors using your email to exfil sensitive data.
Yeah. And I imagine that implementing DLP on email is probably a lot easier than implementing DLP on the endpoint, because you should only have one email system that you have to deal with. You don't have to install agents across the enterprise. You don't have to worry about all the files you have everywhere and watching network traffic and all that.
Right. Because it's a choke point. But something else that shows that if you have that large percentage where individuals are doing this by accident, you probably need to look at what your employees are doing. Because if you have employees that are dealing with sensitive data all day, these are probably the ones that are making these kinds of mistakes. So ensuring that those employees have good procedures, they have good tools that actually facilitate the safe management and distribution of the sensitive data they have, encrypted email and things of that nature. Ensure that they get good training on those procedures and processes and tools also.
All right. And from my last one, like I said, I got all the good ones. Ransomware doubled again from 5% of breaches in 2019 to 10% in 2020. Whew. This is ridiculous. And it's interesting. Business email compromise quadrupled, ransomware doubled. I wonder how much longer this can continue on. I noticed we didn't really talk about any of the ones that dropped. Maybe I should have picked out some that had actually fallen. But anyways, I guess this is not really surprising anybody. They had a couple of interesting things here. They said 7.8% of organizations attempted to download a piece of ransomware. I call bullshit. I think that number is actually way higher. That's probably only the logs they found, but the ones that were reported. I would probably say that somewhere around 80% of organizations have attempted to download a piece of ransomware in the last year. That'd be my guess.
I think you need to look at the semantics. Because 7.8% attempted to download malware or ransomware.
Yeah.
The other 70% did download ransomware. So it's all a matter of the language.
No, I guess that's possible. Yeah, I was reading this as basically either the proxy stopped it or the antivirus stopped it. Was what I was reading it as.
Yeah, 7.8% of the time. They were 70% of the time they were good to go.
That's fair. The big thing that I was surprised about here, honestly, I would have thought it was the opposite. 60% of ransomware installs were through desktop sharing apps. The rest is split through email, network propagation, and other malware. I would have guessed that 60% came from email, but I guess email probably doesn't really get the attackers where they want to go, because the attackers don't really care about crypto lockering the endpoints that the users are using, because those are easily replaceable. They really got to get to the servers. So I guess I was probably just looking at that the wrong way.
Yeah, you were thinking about the beachhead versus
You know what? Yeah, this doesn't say like where the original install was from. The original, and yeah, the beachhead. Where did the attacker get in with? Although looking at the other ones we talked about for the web app attack and the hacking, how those were all credential stuffing, that would jibe really well with this, where the credential stuffing attack on RDP or SSH allows them the access to install it. So I guess my only other question is that this can't double forever. When does it stop? It stops when the operating system vendors figure out a fix, right?
I don't know. You can always multiply by two.
In numbers, yes. But in percentages, no. 10%, 20%, 40%, 80%, 160%. It's all ransomware twice on 60% of the systems.
Maybe go back to the old days where you had attackers kicking each other out of systems that they owned.
And patching them and stuff like that. Yeah.
All right. So the last one we have here is talking about misdelivery. And this is what we talked about a little bit in financial services. This is the number of breaches that are caused by the accidental transmission of sensitive information by employees to somewhere where it shouldn't go. So email to wrong distribution list, physical mail to the wrong people. So misdelivery accounts for 30% of all mistakes. It's 55% in financial services and 36% in healthcare. So this kind of goes back to what we were talking about a second ago, where training the people who handle sensitive information on a regular basis and having them or providing them with the tools necessary in order to ensure the protection of that data is critical in order to minimize these kinds of issues and problems, as well as making sure you monitor to ensure that they are following those processes. And when they make a mistake, that they get residual or additional training to help prevent that in the future.
Yeah, the only really thing that I've got to say here is people are still using physical mail.
Yeah, I get mailbox full of junk every day.
Yeah, there's never anything fun that comes through there.
No, that's because the partnership, the way that the post office makes their money now is not really through stamps and stuff like that. They have agreements with companies to send junk mail.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. But you get the envelope that says resident. Oh, yeah. Awesome. I don't know that guy.
Yeah. I get a surprising amount of mail for the American Association of Retired People.
Me too.
Geez. Yeah.
You know why I think I get it? Is I've applied there.
I haven't applied there, but I still get it. I think I started getting it when I was 30. I figure at this point, it's just they're in it for the long haul to make sure that I am fully and completely aware of everything they offer.
Yeah. It's reinforcement learning. Like they send you junk mail for 30 years until you actually get to that age. And they're like, oh.
Yeah, there'll be no room for anything else in my head, but it's working. They got a mention on the podcast. They haven't even sponsored us.
Yeah. You've been conditioned. All right. That's all we have for the DBIR. Thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec. And please download and listen to us on your favorite podcast app.